This is an ABC podcast.
Everywhere you go, everything you do, you're leaving a digital trail full of information about you. And insurance companies are hoovering it up. More on what's happening and what it means later in the show. Hello, I'm Richard Adey. This is The Money. And the phrase of the week, a thing that was invented as long ago as today, has to be capacity mechanism. Polly Hemming is advisor, climate and energy program at the progressive think tank, the Australia Institute. Polly, what are we talking about here?
It's actually a concept we are already familiar with in our lives. It's just when it's in relation to something as abstract as energy, it seems complicated. And then you chuck a mechanism on the end and it seems even kind of more impenetrable. Basically, it's paying for a product to be available to us when we need it. So usually we pay companies for the products that they supply. So we might pay tomato farms for the tomatoes they produce or cafes for the coffee they sell. But neither of those things are really essential to our lives. So we don't usually pay a cafe. Well, it depends how essential coffee is to your life. We don't normally pay a cafe to be on standby in case people want coffee. However, there are other products and services in our lives that are more essential, and we need to know that they're going to be available when we need them, like firefighters or ambulances or the army. So the government pays for extra capacity from these services. They pay them to be on standby for us. And that's basically what this capacity mechanism is.
Right.
It's paying for generators, electricity generators, to be on standby in case we need electricity.
So in case if there's a shortage in supply, as we've seen recently, or extra demand, as we've also seen because we've had this cold spell.
Yeah, exactly. And just to know that it's available in the future in case the existing generation is unreliable sometimes. So this is just paying for a backup.
Right. Is another way to think about it sort of instant insurance? Something crops up, there's a shortfall, you push a button, there it is.
Well, it depends. So something like a battery is definitely a form of insurance for our electricity system. And throughout history in our electricity system, we've actually had more electricity generation than was needed. So when we got a hot spell or a cold snap, we didn't get blackouts. So the idea is that, yes, we do have some insurance in the system. But the problem is that in the past decade, there's been a real failure to build what we call new electricity generation equipment. And at the same time, a lot of our 50-year-old power stations are either closing down or breaking down with growing frequency. So we've always had insurance, but the insurance has been run down in the past decade. The current situation is probably a better analogy. It's like having medical insurance without having any investment in new medical procedures in the meantime. So then by the time you need it, you turn up to the doctor who wants to carry out some sort of antiquated procedure like trepanning.
Yes.
It's insurance that's not necessarily fit for purpose now.
Yes. Don't worry, because after the trepanning, we'll use leeches to clean everything out. It'll be great.
Yeah. So it is, in what is being proposed is insurance using not necessarily terribly reliable or fit for purpose electricity generation like coal.
So where do we stand now with the process?
Well, this is all being driven by a board called the Energy Security Board, which was put together by energy ministers who were helping to design, well, a redesign of Australia's sort of national electricity market. And it's taken them 5 years to reach the current proposal, which is still very, very high level. And it should be in place within the next 3 years, but we're really lacking all the details. We're trying to basically build the plane at the same time as flying it. And by that, I mean someone else who's consulting on this process, the Australian Energy Market Operator, has said that the transition is actually outpacing the Energy Security Board's own planning cycle.
So things are going faster than they had planned for us.
Well, yes, in real time, in the real world, things are going faster. The planning is going very, very slowly.
In a way, Polly, we have had a capacity mechanism. That's, in fact, what was the function of the fast spin-up open-cycle gas-fired power stations. You didn't turn them on until electricity was expensive, but they can spin up very quickly and push it out there.
Yeah, that's true, but that's not a solution. Firstly, that's an incredibly expensive way of having standby electricity because it only runs at a really high price for electricity. Mm-hmm. It's also now going to be constrained by the fact that we have really, really high gas prices in Australia. And the reason why we have these high gas prices is because most of our gas is exported. That's not a solution. And we haven't even got to the fact that it's absolutely terrible for climate to keep relying on gas-fired power.
Indeed. Methane being an enormously powerful greenhouse gas. So, okay, this additional capacity, where will it come from?
Well, we're going to need a lot of it. We will need, according to the Energy Security Board, about seven times more than all the capacity we've built over the last 24 years. But ultimately, all of the capacity will come from solar and wind storage in Australia. The Labor government has committed to 82% of renewables in the electricity market by 2030. But the states are also doing a lot of heavy lifting currently. I think New South Wales government has committed to big renewable energy zones, and the Victorian government has big plans for offshore wind. Obviously, we've got Snowy 2.0, which is late, but it is coming.
Late and getting later, actually.
Late. Yeah, the simple fact is that renewables are cheaper than fossil fuels. So we know what the end result will be. But after 10 years and 22 proposed climate policies, we're just not sure what the path to that destination is going to look like. Like, how long are we going to be propping up old coal-fired power stations that break down to get there?
Because it's not just the wind and solar, we're also going to need batteries, and we're going to need the networks that take the electricity from the wind and solar, because they're not necessarily in the same places as the coal-fired power stations. One of the points of contention is that it doesn't rule out that capacity coming from coal and gas. And in fact, what that could do is prolong the life of some of these coal-fired stations.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's why this issue is getting so much scrutiny, even though there's not a lot of detail beyond sort of this top-line announcement from ministers. There's a real danger that, yet again, energy policy in Australia will be used to slow the shift to renewables rather than speed it up. So we talk about this capacity market for electricity generation. It's not really a market. It's kind of a government grant scheme where different kind of generators will bid to be on standby to deliver electricity in future in case we need more or the existing generation is unreliable, like we talked about before. But the problem is, in Australia, a lot of the existing generators that are available to be on standby are coal-fired power stations, which break down a lot, and you don't know when they're going to break down. So you really need to be having simultaneous broad-scale investment in renewable energy, and that's fine if the states are doing it, but we don't actually have a federal plan to do that yet. What we should be aiming for is investing. Chris Bowen has this $20 billion fund as part of his Rewiring Australia policy, and so much of that could go towards battery storage. You know, we actually need to be simultaneously investing in renewable energy and storage and, as you said, transition, not just paying the incumbents, these existing old creaking, polluting generators, to be on standby.
So, okay, well, it makes me pessimistic about this next question because I'm wondering if we have ballpark figures on how long this is going to take and what it's going to cost.
Well, I think the momentum's there. We've just elected a new government who is committed to getting 82% of renewables in the grid by 2030. We've also elected a suite of really climate ambitious Teals and Greens into Parliament. Don't be too pessimistic. In terms of what it's going to cost, the process of building new generation capacity is never going to end. We've never stopped building houses. We've never stopped building roads in Australia, and we'll never stop building electricity generation. We need to just move on from the big quick fix and just actually accept that we will be building and rebuilding our energy system for the next 100 years. It's just how we do it. It's always going to be a cost. The money is going to be there. We've got the money. It's just where we direct it.
That might be a good point to finish, Polly. Thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Polly Hemming from the Australia Institute. And this is The Money on RN and wherever you get your podcasts. As you'll be aware, the new government will commission a review of the Reserve Bank. Treasurer Jim Chalmers is sorting out the details at the moment. It comes at a time when the RBA has been the subject of some criticism. Its prediction last year that interest rates wouldn't rise before 2024 were, well, the technical term is completely wrong. And new research suggests it got other things wrong too. Monash economist Isaac Gross worked with former economics professor and now Assistant Minister for Competition, Charities and Treasury, Andrew Lee. They looked at the effect of the RBA's interest rate setting in three trying periods: the global downturn in 2001, the GFC from 2008, and the 4 years leading up to the pandemic. Here's Isaac Gross.
So in 2001, the Reserve Bank did relatively well. They cut interest rates quite substantially in response to both the tech wreck and the September 11 attacks. And these low interest rates made it a lot easier for households to borrow, for businesses to invest. And that had the effect of stabilizing the economy in the wake of this global downturn and meant that the unemployment rate was quite a bit lower than it otherwise would have been. So we estimate that if they hadn't acted, the unemployment rate would have risen to 7%. But in practice, it was less than 6%.
Okay, what about in the GFC though?
So the global financial crisis was a much bigger crisis. And so while the Reserve Bank of Australia cut interest rates again fairly aggressively from 7.25% to around 3%, the unemployment rate still rose during that period. So they weren't able to fully offset the global financial crisis, but they did a pretty good job. And so our model suggests if they hadn't acted, the unemployment rate would have gotten as high as 8%, which would have been quite a dire recession. But instead, they managed to keep it close to 5%. Which is a pretty good outcome given the big shocks that were roiling the global economy at the time.
Yeah, yeah. So if the RBA was one of your students, Zach, what mark would you be giving?
Well, I think for these first two periods, you'd have to give them a solid A. Obviously, nobody's perfect, but in the wake of two pretty substantial shocks to the global economy, they did a pretty good job of keeping Australia out of recession, or at least a formal recession.
All right. So now we come to the more recent period that you looked at. This is in the 4 years leading up to the pandemic. What was going on in the economy at the time?
So this was an interesting period in the Australian economy. You know, there was no obvious global downturn or recession at the time. But starting in 2016, we started to see the Australian economy get weaker and weaker. So we no longer had the mining boom powering us along, or at least the mining boom had substantially slowed. And we saw a period where inflation was quite low, below 2%, the RBA's target band. And we saw wage growth fall off a cliff. And the unemployment rate started to become quite high. Not as high as what we saw during the global financial crisis, perhaps, but still well above where it should be, given an Australian economy at full employment.
Mm. So these are different sorts of problems to the ones we talked about earlier, which were more of a, well, the GFC in particular was a kind of shock. How did the RBA go in addressing them?
So, as I mentioned earlier, during the global financial crisis and in 2001, the Reserve Bank of Australia cut interest rates aggressively. But in 2016, they didn't cut them by that much at all, really. So they started off at about 1.75% and they cut them a couple times over that 4 years. But really, they mostly kept the interest rate constant, despite the fact that inflation was low and unemployment was high, which are all the classic signs of a low level of aggregate demand. And what this relative inaction meant was that the unemployment rate was kept higher than was necessary. And so when we used the RBA's model to evaluate what the optimal path for interest rates would have been, we find that the best thing to do would have been to cut interest rates aggressively, perhaps even close to zero. And we find that because the RBA didn't cut interest rates, this cost the Australian economy the equivalent of 270,000 people being out of work for 1 year.
That is a lot. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But they started, I think interest rates started at 1.75%, you said. They don't have as much room, though, do they, at 1.75% than when interest rates are at, say, 3 or 4%.
That's true. They don't have as much room to go to decrease, given that the Reserve Bank of Australia has ruled out negative interest rates. But that doesn't mean you can't cut them down to zero. And as we saw during the COVID-19 crisis, that doesn't mean that you can't use other tools, such as quantitative easing, to further stimulate the economy when interest rates are at 0%. And so if it wants to boost monetary stimulus to the economy, it's certainly got other options that it can turn to.
All right. So you said, I think, 270,000 jobs. That sounds like a lot. Can I get you to put it into context?
By way of comparison, the Melbourne Suburban Rail Loop, which is a ginormous infrastructure project down in Melbourne, that's estimated to create only 8,000 jobs during its first stage of construction. So 8,000 versus 270,000. You can compare it to the Inland National Rail, and that's estimated to create 20,000 jobs, so less than a tenth of the number of jobs destroyed in this period. And in fact, if you look back at to when Australia closed its border, that's estimated to have cost us 72,000 jobs, less than a third of the number of jobs that Australia lost in this pre-pandemic period. So these are all massive public projects or big policy decisions, but really they're all dwarfed by the bank's decision to run the economy too slow over that pre-pandemic period.
Why do you think the bank chose this line?
Look, it's a good question, and we discuss a number of possible theories in our paper. I think the most likely explanation, or perhaps the main explanation, is that the bank was concerned that it didn't want to boost house prices at the time. In particular, this is mentioned in both the board minutes, and Governor Phil Lowe mentioned it in a speech as a reason why he would be reluctant to lower interest rates. And so I think that was the main motivation for refusing to increase the level of employment in the economy and boost economic growth, because they didn't want house prices to get too high. More recently, he's leaned away from this concept. I think he's given speeches where he's actively said that he's not targeting house prices and that would be a bad idea. But I think that's the most likely explanation of why they refused to cut interest rates at the time.
Right. So if we go back to the idea of the student you're grading, what does the RBA get for the period before COVID?
Well, all the research suggests that trying to target house prices using a central bank's interest rate is a bad idea. The Reserve Bank's own researchers have found that the costs of this approach of trying to control house prices is far outweighed by whatever benefits you can gain. So if you were to grade this period, you have to say, well, low inflation below the target was an error, high unemployment was quite costly, and wage growth, of course, was bad for households across Australia. So I think you would say at best maybe a C minus for this period, certainly a period in which substantial errors were made.
All right. So what about since then, Zach?
So since then is a period we haven't formally modelled. The COVID-19 crisis, I think, is sort of still playing out, and maybe in a few years' time we'll do a sequel where we analyse what happened during COVID-19. I think you'd have to grade a bit on a curve when it comes to the pandemic. Obviously, it's a pretty unique economic crisis. And so while I think the bank wasn't flawless during COVID-19, I think it did a pretty good job. They were quick to ease monetary policy in March 2020 and ramp up that stimulus when more stimulus was needed. And so today, when we have sort of the reverse problem where inflation is perhaps too high and maybe we've overstimulated the economy, I think you could say, look, mistakes have been made and maybe they overstimulated too much. But at the end of the day, that's only a decision we can make with 2020 hindsight, and that the decisions they made at the time to push unemployment as low as possible were probably the right ones, even if they did over-egg it a bit.
All right. Well, I'm sure you, like me, will be a very interested observer when we find out more about the shape of the review of the RBA this year. Isaac Gross, thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Thanks for having me.
Isaac Gross is at Monash University. When you're applying for insurance cover, you usually have to fill in a form. You certainly answer some questions, but what you divulge isn't the full story. Now, a new study suggests that insurance companies are using big data and algorithms to access massive amounts of information about you. Sophia Bentnars from the University of Sydney explains.
The main thing that we're concerned about here is getting that information from so-called external sources. And it raises, I think, a number of issues. it's unexpected, you know, it's surprising. So imagine going a grocery shopping, you know, you always scan your customer loyalty card because it gives you all those freebies and, you know, promotions and stuff. So you use that, but you don't really think that it may ever have any influence on your insurance products that you're offered, on the prices of your insurance products, but it may. So that's one thing. Yeah. The second problem is that, you know, if they collect all this data, the way they would use it, they would use some very powerful, sophisticated models, such as AI models, for example. And those models will give certain outcomes or predictions that might simply be inaccurate. But even if they are true or inaccurate, they just may be unfair. So let me give you an example. There are studies that show that if you use certain operating systems on your smartphone, that means that you're a safer driver.
Okay, now I have to know now. I've got an iPhone. What does that say?
So potentially it says that you're not as safe a driver than a person that uses an Android phone is.
Right.
And this is regardless of your age or, you know, gender or income level. But would it be fair for them to use this rating factor to price your insurance?
I would not.
Well, I wouldn't say so.
No.
Exactly.
Traditionally, that hasn't been how they've done it. But anyway, so I just want to backtrack a bit. You're saying they can now access information about me, or indeed anybody else, from, I suppose, not just a customer loyalty card, but there'll be all sorts of data out there about all of us these days.
Practically any digital trace that we leave from, you know, browsing the web or using all these smartphone apps and watching TV streaming services, your online shopping, the things that you post on social media, not to mention wearable fitness tracking devices. You know, we leave these digital traces and they can potentially be harvested.
When you put it like that, I'm trying to work out how much of a digital trace we leave. It must be massive every single day. So what does the ability to comb these huge data sets with algorithms give the insurer? What does it tell them about me?
It definitely allows for a more precise risk assessment. So that's one thing. But it's not only this. It may allow them to find out about your behavior patterns. So it makes it possible to analyze, for example, your willingness to pay, or if it's really urgent for you to purchase insurance, and then they might just give you a higher price for a product.
Because I was thinking, if the insurance industry will say, hang on, we need to be able to assess the risk accurately. This gives us an unprecedented opportunity to do that.
And it's true. If it's always fair, as we said, it doesn't have to be fair. And another problem is that all those models, they work on correlations and not causation. So there isn't a causal link between the fact that you're using an iPhone or an Android phone and how you drive. It's probably just a correlation, right?
Yeah.
And this is what they find out.
And the other thing, of course, is this is mostly going on without us thinking about it. You're pointing it out today, but I'm sure this has been going on for a while. Actually, are we sure this is, in fact, already happening?
So there is a big issue with transparency in insurance industry, and especially insurance pricing. It's not transparent at all, but we do have indications that it's already been going on for quite a while. So, for example, in 2019, the New York State Department of Financial Services issued a circular letter regarding the underwriting of life insurance, with some really specific requirements as to how the external data can be used to underwrite life insurance. And then we have surveys that were conducted by the regulators in the UK and the European Union that show that insurance companies, obviously anonymously, admit to collecting consumers' external data. So we know that it's been going on for at least a few years, probably not more than five.
You're concerned as well, though, that this could get easier for the insurers to do.
Yes, and this is actually a very good point, because I don't know if you've heard about it, but we're currently rolling out the so-called consumer data right, and it's already active in banking, and it's going to be expanded to other industries. And it would mean that an insurer can ask you to provide your data. For example, currently that would be just banking data, but that includes transaction data for the last, say, 5 years.
Right.
And in order to access a specific product, they may make it conditional upon your sharing that data.
Right. This has been trumpeted by the banking industry as part of something they call open banking. And it's supposed to be a good thing for the consumer. This would enable me to ask my bank to share information with an app on my phone so that I could do things that the bank doesn't offer. It's supposed to be a good thing.
And I think it definitely is a good thing in many aspects in different industries. So if we're looking at the energy sector, that's a completely different thing. But there is an important risk that it might affect consumers in a negative way, and especially in insurance context. And I have two main concerns here. First, you know, if they ask you to share your banking data from the last 5 years, it's completely non-transparent. Again, you wouldn't know what they're looking for in that data to price your risk. And secondly, you know, what about people who cannot or just simply don't want to share their data? If this offer is conditional upon you sharing that data, then it's either you do it or you just don't get it.
Right, indeed. As I listen to you, I'm thinking, so the problems you've identified are that A, it's at least surreptitious. It's not exactly secret, but we're not aware of it happening. And we probably don't think about the data trail that we leave as we move through life, what we're giving away. And then the other thing is the way they use it, we don't know whether it's fair or even legitimate, but probably the motivation is trying to work out how much we're prepared to pay for insurance. Both of these things sound like something ordinary consumers wouldn't be particularly keen on. What can we,
exactly.
What can we do about it? Are there solutions?
The thing is that the solutions must come from policymakers and regulators, because we can't reasonably expect consumers to just try to not leave those digital traces in today's society, right? So from, again, a regulatory perspective, could be, for example, prohibition on the use of external data or limits on how you can use that data. So, for example, mandating more transparency or requiring that there is this causal link between the rating factor that we use and the final price, right? If it's just a correlation which you can't explain, then, well, you can't use it.
Right. Now, what about compliance, Sophia? Because it's one thing to require something. It's quite another to ensure that that requirement is followed.
I think, again, this is a question for regulators first, policymakers, and also the industry through their Insurance Council of Australia, for example. Those are the bodies that really will have to look into it and ensure that there is the adequate compliance.
Yeah, although, of course, the Insurance Council of Australia is really a kind of peak body representing the interests of insurance companies rather than their policyholders.
Oh, yeah, well, definitely. But then they are the ones that should just tell their members that this is the time to do the right thing.
Right. Well, this has been really interesting and a little bit disconcerting, I have to say, Sophia. And I, given away the fact that I have an iPhone, but I don't want you to impugn anything about my driving.
I won't.
Thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Sophia Bentnarz is in the law school at the University of Sydney. That's it for The Money. Next time we'll look at Super, which is coming up for its 30th birthday. Thanks to producer Kate McDonald and sound engineer Simon Branthwaite. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.